As AI continues to revolutionize our world, there's a critical conversation we can't ignore: AI safety and security. And that's where HackerOne's AI red teaming comes into play, rigorously testing AI models to prevent them from being misled or exploited. HackerOne employs over 2 million ethical hackers, and 750 of them specialize in prompt hacking and other AI security and testing. So HackerOne isn't just theorizing, they're actively safeguarding AI's future. Just recently, a team unearthed over 100 vulnerabilities in just 2 weeks. So whether you're at the helm of a startup or steering product innovation at a large company, it's time to prioritize AI security. Visit HackerOne.com/AI for more. Again, HackerOne.com/AI.
This episode is sponsored by porkbun.com. Porkbun is a refreshingly different domain name registrar that's different from the other ones like GoDaddy or Namecheap. They've got low prices on hundreds of different domain extensions. They've got everything from .com domains to really cool ones like .pro, .dev, .xyz. Every domain name at Porkbun comes with tons of freebies too, like SSL certificate, whois privacy, DNS, URL forwarding, and hosting trials. Because why pay for things that should be free, right? All these incredible features and tools are backed by incredible support, 365 days a year, and more 5-star reviews on Trustpilot from real customers than anyone else. Look, you can get $1 off your next domain name from Porkbun and see why they're the best domain name registrar around by using our code. Just go to porkbun.com/rocketshipfm24. That's porkbun, porkbun.com/rocketshipfm24. You'll save $1 on your next domain. This episode is brought to you by Gigantic. At Gigantic, you can level up your product skills through live, small group, cohort-based trainings. We're incredibly excited to welcome you to our next cohort of our product strategy training, kicking off in January of 2024. This course will take you through the frameworks that product leaders use at companies like eBay, DoorDash, Groupon, Rent the Runway, in order to scale their teams. It's taught by Ben Foster, a friend of this podcast, who is the former chief product officer at Whoop. So come join us. Go to gigantic.is. That's gigantic.is. And save your seat for our January cohort. Your potential is gigantic, and we're here to help you reach it. Go to gigantic.is to reserve your seat today. Today, I talked with Raghav Ball, who is the founder of Quintype. Now, Quintype recently partnered with Bloomberg to develop some digital video properties. And this is a huge partnership, but not the first for Raghav. Raghav built an empire in India. He's known as the Rupert Murdoch of India, in fact, for his partnership specifically with Viacom, which allowed Viacom to break into the Indian market. So we talked to him about his entrepreneurial journey, about how he's leveraged partnerships successfully throughout his career, and what he's building now with Quintype. Welcome to Rocketship.fm, the podcast where we explore startups from funding to growth, from culture to sales, and everything in between. I'm Michael Saka.
And I'm Joelle Goldman.
If we could start at the beginning, I'd love to hear, you know, how you got into media and how that became kind of your calling in the 90s.
Yeah, so, you know, I had a pretty regular start, as a lot of middle-class Indian boys do. My father was in the civil services, you know, so we never had too much money as a family, but we were fine, you know, got good education, lived in some of the best cities and towns. So it was a decent upper middle class upbringing, I would say. But, you know, I didn't want to follow my father into the civil services. I just wanted to be in the corporate sector or be more in the sort of private enterprise space. So I joined, I finished my college, I finished my MBA from Delhi University, and I then joined the corporate sector. I joined a consultancy, then joined American Express Bank very briefly. So about for the first 4 years of my life, I spent in the corporate sector. But, you know, all through my college days, I was always interested in doing a sort of public speaking or telecasting on the side as a hobby. And you could only do it as a hobby because India did not recognize private television in those days, in the 80s. We only had one state-controlled broadcaster. So there was one channel, it was controlled by the state, and therefore there was no question of doing anything private, but you could be associated with it as a freelancer, someone as a hobby. So we used to get a tiny stipend, you know, something like $15 to do a show. I'm talking about the mid-80s. But it was fun. It was fun. You were in college and it was extra pocket money and it was fun and you got recognized. You know, the girls liked you. So,
what kind of shows were these? Were they like interview shows or entertainment shows?
They were largely interview and discussion based. Okay. Focused at the young people. So it was a youth audience. And lastly, issues concerning the youth. So this was mid-80s, very different India from what India is today. So I was always doing that as a hobby. But you know, what happened towards the end of the 80s and early 90s was one of the Indian, private Indian media companies, they started something, you know, they started a magazine on a video cassette. This was sort of a proxy private television in India. It was proxy because we were not allowed to broadcast. So what they would do is, just as you would print a magazine on paper, they would actually publish video stories in a video cassette and distribute it like a magazine.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you know, and that was a typically Indian innovation because the state controlled the broadcasting, but suddenly this thing became very popular because it was a proxy for private news. The cassettes became very popular and I used to sort of anchor it and front it. So that gave me a little bit of boost of popularity myself. And that coincided towards the end of 80s, early 90s with satellite television. Satellite TV came to India when CNN started broadcasting visuals from the Gulf War of 91. So there was no regulation. And there's no way you can stop a satellite signal from falling into your country unless you jam it. So no one knew about jammers, nothing. So the satellite signals started coming in and people with large dish antennas started catching them. And the whole thing spread like wildfire because people said, you know, there's something called the satellite TV and you can put a big dish antenna and then you can see the pictures live. So in about 2 years, between 91 and 93, satellite TV grew unregulated and grew like wildfire.
Totally, yeah.
And then it occurred to me that I can convert my hobby into business because, you know, I was a student of business and I was in the corporate sector, so I understood business issues. But I also had broadcasting as a hobby, which got better refined when I was doing this private video cassette. So I think, you know, putting two and two together, I said, well, you know, India is such a large democracy. It mimics the U.S. in several ways. It's a very large, freedom-based, retail-led society. That no way would Indians be happy consuming just overseas content. Indians would want their own content. Because we had it's a strange country. We had a legacy of the free press. So our English language and our vernacular language press was free for 150 years. But broadcasting was state-controlled. Hmm. But suddenly you saw that broadcasting could bypass the state through satellite TV. So as I said, one thing led to another. I said, well, this is a good enough opportunity. Let's jump at it. So I, set up a television program production outfit. We produced a couple of pilots, one as a business news magazine, weekly business news magazine, another a sort of weekly lifestyles, feature-based sort of programming. These two luckily were picked up by two overseas channels. One was BBC World. The other was, Star TV, which was then owned by Rupert Murdoch, Hong Kong. So they both of them liked the show. So we got commissioned for both shows together. So that was a great stroke of luck. So we just set up the company and we got these two pilots out. Satellite TV was, you know, really growing. Both these guys liked our shows. They commissioned both the shows. Our little production company, you know, fledgling little production company that I'd set up with sort of $2,000. Really took off.
Wow. So 2000 is what you started with.
Yes, 50,000 rupees. And I think at that time, the exchange rate was about 25 rupees to the dollar.
Okay.
So yeah, $2,000. Yeah.
Wow. Wow. And that got the equipment and production and.
Yeah. So then once we got commissioned with these two shows, we went and picked up some capital from friends and associates. And then we went and picked up some capital from private equity companies. There was round one private equity, round two private equity. I really call it, you know, as with several things in life, there is a fortuitous confluence of circumstance. I was willing to be an entrepreneur, so I left my job. What I was doing as a hobby could become my vocation. India opened up and liberalized to things like private equity and venture capital, which was unheard of in India in the 80s. Satellite television happened, you know. So all these things happened together. And one thing led to another. So we grew. We did more shows. Two shows became 10 shows, became 15 shows. More private equity came in. And then finally, we became partners with CNBC, who wanted to launch a 24-hour Indian business channel. We became their partners. Under Indian law, we had to hold majority. So we became the dominant partner. We did an IPO. You know, and from then on, you know how it is. Once things take off, they take off. But then once you get to another, CNBC led to a partnership with CNN for general news. That led to a partnership with Viacom for an MTV for entertainment programming, with Forbes for a business news magazine. So net, we were in the year 2000, we were about a $2 million revenue company. And by about 2014, when I finally exited, our revenues had, our group revenues were close to $1 billion. So I think, you know, we sort of grew from there.
Incredible. Yeah, absolutely. And it sounds like you were kind of the gateway for a lot of these media companies into India. They came to you because you understood the market. You had kind of a competitive advantage there. And so they came to you for that reason.
Yes. So we could boast amongst all Indian media companies. We boasted of about 6 joint venture relationships with these very large American corporations. Everybody else who got into bed with these Indian partners, many of them fell by the wayside and JVs didn't work out. But ours, all of them worked. I mean, you know, at one time, we had CNBC, CNN, so that's GE during those days, CNN, Time Warner, Viacom, Forbes, and A&E Networks, which is the History TV, History Channel.
Okay.
So we had a joint venture with them as well. So at one time, we had these 5, 6 JVs with large American corporations. But we managed to run all of them very successfully because, we completely believed in playing level and fair. And that's one big lesson that I had during those old innings, that American companies make for good partners, provided both sides are willing to be fair and transparent and, you know, not try and do stuff on the side, which is not good for partnership.
When Rainn Wilson realized he had a special gift for talking people to sleep, he had two choices: construct a massive speaker that would blast his voice to every person in the country, or invent a talking pillow. AT&T Business eventually talked him into the pillow thing. And backed by a reliable network, the only network with built-in security controls, Sleep with Rainn was a hit. Take your ideas to the moon and beyond at business.att.com. That's business.att.com. This episode is brought to you by Yahoo Finance. Wouldn't it be great if you could see all of your investment and retirement accounts in one place? With Yahoo Finance, you can consolidate your views with multiple accounts into one hub and access the expert analysis you need to tend to your entire portfolio with confidence. Honestly, this has been a lifesaver for me. I've used Yahoo Finance to consolidate all of my various 401k and investment accounts so I can see everything all in one place. And it makes it incredibly easy to manage. So if you're struggling with that, check out Yahoo Finance. For over 25 years, Yahoo Finance has been the brand behind every great investor. You can securely link your brokerage accounts for a unified view of your wealth, including your 401k and other investments. A comprehensive perspective is what sets apart a great investor, and that's how Yahoo Finance ensures that you have the insights to look at your wealth in its entirety. So go to yahoofinance.com. That's yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination.
So were there, I guess, like, what made them so successful? Was it the contract or was it the people that made those partnerships really work?
Clearly people.
Yeah.
Clearly people. I mean, contracts are pretty standard templated stuff.
Okay. Yeah.
But it's the people, it's the, you know, the synergy that the partnership brought in. With CNN and IBM, we had a global brand, we had global content coming in from CNN. We had a very nice bunch of Indian journalists who were creating great Indian content. So there was great synergy. So big news broke across the world. We had access to all of CNN's facilities and CNN's programming cloud and news cloud. And if something big happened in India, we had our own infrastructure. So, and likewise with CNBC. So, I think it was a wonderful synergy of people and a very constructive partnership. Both the partners brought to the table, their combined energy.
Mm-hmm. And I just like to understand, was CNBC a name in India at the time? Like, did that hold weight with the people?
No.
So it was actually you giving kind of CNBC the clout, if you will, among the people in India.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I think it'd be fair to say that because CNBC started in the US only in the early 90s. Yep. So it was sort of barely known globally. So we brought it to India. But, you know, again, a lot of these things are fortuitous because the Indian stock markets were just taking off. India had just sort of opened up its economy to the world from being a very closed socialist economy in the 80s, it became a private sector oriented, free market oriented, open economy in the 90s. So the stock markets were sort of on a real ride. You know, they were sort of, you know, really growing 20-25%. So the stock markets were up, and as I told you, India is a very in societal structures, India is very similar to the US because it's a very large population, it's a very diverse population. People speak a lot of languages here. It's a very retail led population. So the stock markets took off. And with that, CNBC came in as sort of, you know, it was an idea whose time had come in India. So it really took off with us, with CNBC TV 18 as a joint brand. I mean, you'd be interested to know that. Outside of the US, the only other profitable franchise of CNBC in the world was CNBC TV 18 in India. They are really? Still in investment mode. Yes, they're still
That's
in
incredible.
Investment mode. In Europe, they're making investments still. In Asia, they're making investments still. In Japan, they're making investments. In Middle East, they're making investments. In Africa, they're making investments.
Yeah.
Only here that we are generating almost, 20, when I left, we were generating almost 25 to 30 million of cash.
Wow. What is the big difference? Is it because our demographics are so similar?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. The demographics are very similar. It's a retail-led market. Unlike all the other markets that I just rattled off, except for Africa, which could also become a retail-led market. The others are all institutional markets.
Yeah.
Singapore is institutional. Europe is very institutional. So I think it's really the size of the market, the structure of the market, and the time. I mean, you know, the Indian markets were just on a roll.
Yeah. So, I mean, before we get to today, I want to find out a little bit more about these partnerships and what you did to structure them successfully. Like you said, it's the people, but it's the communication too. Was there anything that you would tell, you know, an entrepreneur today setting up partnerships that they should look for, or that like that they should kind of communicate with another company that they're looking to partner with?
Yeah, so you know, this is a question I've sort of asked myself, and people have asked as well. How is it that you ran such successful joint ventures when nobody else was able to do that? It's a complex answer, but if I was to whittle it down to one line, I would say you've got to have the ability. And this is, I think, the secret sauce of running successful partnerships, whether it's a marriage, whether it's a partnership with a friend, or whether it's a joint venture with a big corporation. You've got to have the ability to see it from the other guy's point of view. So whenever you address an issue, you would obviously see it from your point of view. That's normal. That's natural, as human beings always do that. But if you have the ability to transcend to across the divide and look at it from the other guy's point of view, then my sense is that you will always be able to talk your way to a solution. And that, I think, is the secret sauce of good partnerships in life. Can you see it from the other guy's point of view? If you can, then I think your ability to come to solutions, because when there are two people in a room, there will be differences. There will be differences of strategy, there'll be differences, there'll be, you know, if something goes wrong, there'll be sort of blame apportioning. All of that is part of human psychology and human behavior. But for you to be able to successfully transcend those problems and come to solution, which is what makes for longevity in partnerships, I think is the ability to see it from the other guy's point of view. And I think we were able to do that. We were absolutely able to do that. And there's trust, you know, I think and these things lead to trust. And once there is trust, then the person who's sitting remote, because, you know, there's a natural suspicion if you're not on the scene. There's a natural suspicion if you're remote, that things may not be happening the way they're being portrayed. But once that trust builds up, then you get taken for your word. Then you get taken at face value when you say something. So my sense is trust, transparency, ability to see it from the other guy's point of view, and ability to be flexible enough to accommodate a consensus solution. I think that's what makes for partnerships.
I love it. Talk about today. So you've left media in the last couple of years, sounds like 2014. So you're about, you know, year and a half out from media, and you've started Quintype. Tell us a bit about how this came to be. What was the motivation behind it?
So, you know, in 2014, when my wife was co-founder with me, both of us exited Network 18. So, you know, all of a sudden, all the problems that a first generation entrepreneur has went away. You know, there was capital in the bank, there was sufficient track record, you know, you had successfully exited one venture. So, you know, So we sort of asked each other, what should we do now? One option, of course, was to become what a lot of other successful first-generation entrepreneurs become. They become venture capitalists and they start, you know, mentoring other people and investing in other people. We thought we were still a bit young. We thought we still had, you know, 15 years ahead of us, 15 to 20 years ahead of us, where we could do something all over again. So we said, let's start another operating venture rather than just a venture capital business. So we looked around and we said media is what we understand. And we got more and more excited. So we took a trip across the US, New York, Silicon Valley, everywhere. We met people like Vox Media and Mashable and, you know, these new Mike.com, these new age digital media companies. And we realized this is really where media is headed. But along with that came a very important second realization, which is that in this digital mobile first media, it's not just about content. It is a successful marriage of content and technology. Unlike television or unlike magazine publishing, which where technology plays a minuscule role, there is hardly any technology in it. But in the two-way communication of the digital world and the mobile, particularly the mobile handheld world, technology is very important. How are you reaching your consumer? How quickly can you be downloaded? What kind of personalization algorithms are you doing? What is the kind of two-way communication you are setting up with your audiences? How are you harvesting user-generated content? How are you looking at analytics? How are you seeing, how are you parsing your traffic to figure out what audiences are reacting to? All of this is tech-based stuff. So we realized that technology is something we need to put our arms around. We were journalists. We were not engineers and therefore didn't understand technology as well. So it is very clear to us that if we were to launch a media product, and we did launch it, it's consumer facing, it's called the Quint. We also need to put in equal amount of energy and capital into understanding and harnessing technology. And coincidentally, we met Amit Rathore, who's the co-founder of Quintype with us in the Silicon Valley area. It was just a cold meeting. I mean, we went to a meeting with another technology entrepreneur, and there was Amit sitting there, and we got talking. He'd heard of us from Network 18, some of the brands he had seen, so we got talking, and I asked him what he was doing, and he had just exited his first venture that he had set up in the Valley. So he was looking to do something. We were looking to set up a tech shop where we could understand technology along with the media product that we were doing. So it was a combination, a confluence of interests. So we sort of hit off, we liked each other. So, you know, we said, why don't we build a new age digital publishing platform, a SaaS-based platform, which will be open to any publisher in the world who wants to either migrate his old world digital, his old world publishing platforms onto a new age digital publishing platform, or someone like the Quint, like ourselves, who wanted to set up from scratch. So I think that's how the idea of Quintype came up. We started building it. The Quint was the first client on Quintype, and a lot of experimentation happened on the Quint, and a lot of learning, the engineers learning journalism, or what is required in journalism, and journalists learning what technology can do to their content. I think there was a lot of learning in the first 1.5 years, 18 months, which is where we are at now. And I think now we've reached a stage where the product is acquiring a maturity, it's getting new features, it's getting new publishers. It's got, I think, more than a dozen other publishers now, besides the Quint. So I would say we are still at the midpoint. I would say there is another half of our journey left, where we will layer on much more new age features. But I think we've reached that threshold point where others are beginning to trust the digital publishing platform and are coming on.
Very cool. And it looks like, is Quint a partnership with Bloomberg?
No. So the Quint is a standalone product.
Okay.
Then about 6 months back, we got approached by Bloomberg, because Bloomberg had another partnership in India, which was coming to an end after several years. And they were looking for a new partner in India. They'd, of course, seen what we had managed to do with our CNBC partnership in my earlier venture. Also, some of my colleagues at CNBC were now part of Bloomberg. So we now knew each other. Everyone knew each other. So I think Bloomberg reached out and said, would we be interested in a partnership with them to launch a television come digital platform? We liked it. We'd done it before with CNBC. We had no non-compete. I had not signed any non-compete. The Quint was stabilizing. Quintype was stabilizing. You know, both had done about 14 months each. So we thought that was a good venture to get into. So then came Bloomberg Quint, which is a joint venture between the Quint and Bloomberg. So the Quint is a separate product. Quintype is a separate company and product. Bloomberg Quint is a joint venture, which is going to be focused at the finance and business news space only. So it's a vertical. It'll publish off Quintype, because they liked Bloomberg when they saw what we had done with Quintype. They liked the content management system. And they said, why don't we publish Bloomberg Quint on Quintype? We were only too happy because we'd already published the Quint on Quintype. So Bloomberg Quint is now going to become a very large client for Quintype. We hope to go live very soon with the website.
Very cool. That's fantastic. I mean, just leveraging the partnerships. Again, it's brilliant. So for Quintype, is this for publishers? Do you see companies who are, you know, more and more leveraging content as kind of a way to market themselves? Are they able to leverage the platform as well?
Yes.
Okay.
It's not just for publishing. Publishing, because of its nature of being an online product, always reactive, news breaking all around you, is a little bit more complex than a publisher who's not reacting to the environment and is doing things in a more planned manner. So in a sense, that guy, that kind of a client is an easier sell for Quintype, because Quintype is architectured for handling more complex reactive daily news operations. But if someone is not in that environment and is really, say, a corporate publisher or is a blogger, Quintype is very, very, very good for them.
And so what is the difference between like a WordPress or Squarespace, another way to publish that content?
So what, Quintype is going to do more than what some of these others are doing, because Quintype will do everything that they do, number one. But we'll also bundle in advanced analytics. We'll also bundle in personalization engines. We'll be much more technology friendly for the mobile screen than for desktops, because desktops are really sort of, plateauing off. So yes, Quintype will be in the same space as some of these older platforms, which are now reconfiguring themselves for the new age, a digital new age, handheld first digital age. Quintype is building up from scratch and will bring in, as I said, you know, will instead of having plugins with third parties, will actually be building a very seamless platform, and it's SaaS-based. So yes, in the same space, it's a competitor space, but by virtue of being a later startup and by virtue of somebody who's not sort of hobbled by legacy, is able to build on, you know, new age platform, whether it's languages, whether it's coding, whether it's not having to use plugins, but building its own, you know, features like, as I said, analytics, personalization, search, all of these are being built innately in Quintype.
Very cool. Yeah, I think it's a really exciting space, not only for like the changing media, but like at Crew, where I work, we had a blog for the last 4 years, and it's now considered a publication. That's what we're changing, even the vernacular that we refer to it as, into a publication, because we're trying to mimic closer to what a traditional media company would produce. Because it works for marketing. So that, I think it's a really exciting space. That's fantastic.
And it's also, you know, in the East, India and East Asia and Middle East, there is a huge market which is not so serviced by some of the legacy players, older players. So there's also a geographical advantage that Quintype will have.
Well, awesome. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Pleasure talking to you.
Yes, absolutely. If you'd like to check out Quintype, go to quintype.com. And a huge thanks to Raghav for coming on here today. Stay tuned. On Sunday, we have an interview with George Santino, who is a 20-year vet of Microsoft. He started off testing software for them at 35 and then moved all the way up to a partner. So we have a fantastic story of how he grew inside of the organization and the lessons he learned from spending 20 years at Microsoft. So if you haven't yet, hit subscribe. You're not going to want to miss it. Leave us a review on iTunes or Stitcher or Google Play, wherever you get your podcast. Please, it helps us reach more people. You can follow us on Twitter at RocketShipFM. You can follow me at Michael Saka and Joel at Joel Goldman. All right, we'll see you back here in just a couple days.